Patricia Williams teaches commercial law at the University of Wisconsin. When she studies a legal contract, she often thinks back to a purchase agreement that was drawn up four generations ago, when a white lawyer named Austin Miller bought an 11-year-old slave named Sophie. Miller raped Sophie soon after he bought her, and Sophie gave birth to Williams' great-grandmother Mary. The Alchemy of Race and Rights, The Diary of a Law Professor, is the title of a new book by Patricia Williams. She writes that speaking as a black, female, and commercial lawyer has rendered her simultaneously universal, trendy, and marginal. Nevertheless, she's always bringing the subjects of race and gender into the classroom. In her book, she tells a story that she sometimes tells her students.
Now, walking down Fifth Avenue in New York not long ago, I came up behind a couple and their young son. The child, about 4 or 5 years old, had evidently been complaining about big dogs. The mother was saying, "But why are you afraid of big dogs?" "Because they're big," he responded with eminent good sense. "But what's the difference between a big dog and a little dog?" the father persisted. "They're big," said the child. "But there's really no difference," said the mother, pointing to a large, slathering wolfhound with narrow eyes and the calculated amble of a gangster, and then to a beribboned Pekingese the size of a roller skate who was flouncing along just ahead of us all in that little foxtrotty step that keep Pekingese from ever being taken seriously. "See," said the father, "if you look really closely, you'll see there's no difference at all. They're all just dogs." And I thought, talk about your ironclad cannon. Talk about a static, unyielding, totally uncompromising point of reference. These people must be lawyers. Where else do people learn so well the idiocies of high objectivity? How else do people learn to capitulate so uncritically to a norm that refuses to allow for difference? How else do grown-ups sink so deeply into the authoritarianism of their own worldview that they can universalize their relative bigness so completely that they obliterate the subject positioning of their child's relative smallness? To say nothing of the position of the slathering wolfhound, from whose own narrow perspective, I dare say the little boy must have looked exactly like a lamb chop.
This story about the boy who's afraid of big dogs is a story that you sometimes tell in your classes. What are you trying to illustrate by way of this story?
I am trying to illustrate the position of the three-year-old who wants protection against big dogs. And what I am doing metaphorically or in a slightly different context is I think what I am representing in a context that is perhaps less emotionally loaded than in race or gender, the position of relatively disenfranchised people, of relatively less powerful people who make a claim that they see something big and potentially devouring down the line. Can they have protection against it? And the law's response is, but there's no danger, but there's no power difference, even when that is utterly absurd from the disenfranchised person's perspective.
Is there a time in your life where you felt like this boy who was being told, oh, no, all dogs are the same. You shouldn't worry about those big dogs?
Many, many instances. One that comes to mind being here in New York is I went to a store in Soho a little while ago, and there has been in New York an outcropping of buzzers on doors.
We have to get buzzed to let in. They lock the door and you have to ring the bell.
Yes, and you have to ring the bell to get in. And there's been a great deal of discussion in the New York media about the fact that frequently who is buzzed in or who is not buzzed in is a racial determination based on so-called security profiles of who's likely to be a shoplifter or a robber. And somehow all blacks fit the profile of being shoplifters or muggers. Anyway, I went to the store, which I'd been to 1,000 times before, pressed the little buzzer, and they would not let me in. And the store was clearly opened. There were other people in the store, white people in the store. I wrote my sense of rage and disenfranchisement up in an essay, and I was invited to submit this essay to a law review, and during the second edit, they eliminated all reference to my race in this story. And the story, without knowledge of my race, became one either in which I became paranoid. There simply was no basis for my accusations of discrimination without that knowledge. Or it was one in which the reader had to assume that I was black by reading it. and in that process of assumption to engage in a kind of prejudgment of who I must be, and I use prejudgment quite calculatedly as the root of the word prejudice. And in fact, the editor even said, oh, anyone reading the story will know what you must have looked like. At the same time, the official rationale for taking out all reference to my race was cloaked in words that would have been worthy of those parents talking to the young boy about the big dogs. The official reason was, it is a matter of style. We're not explicitly eliminating reference to race. It has nothing to do with race. It is simply a matter of style. Our style book says that there shall be no descriptions of physiognomy. So again, it was legalized, and by legalized, I mean it conformed to the law's best loved inculcations, which are impersonality, neutrality. You don't use words that are at all emotion-laden, and race, as we see, is increasingly emotion-laden. But yet at the same time, it cut out the heart of what this story was about.
So there's times when you think that objectivity and color blindness actually work against you if you are a person of color.
Well, I think that objectivity and color blindness can become precisely subjectivity, like the parent position or the white storekeeper position, as a way of not hearing the little boy position or the me, the brown me standing on the doorstep of the store not being able to get in position. And so what in fact you call objectivity is in fact a contest between two different subjectivities.
I think what you're saying is that sometimes color blindness or objectivity means just seeing it through the point of view of the mainstream or the people in power.
Yes, or becomes, yes, a certain kind of privilege of one view over another, or blindness rather than mere color blindness.
I want to leave aside the word politically correct, but I want to ask
That's
you.
Fine.
I want to ask you what's bothering you, though, about what's happening on campus now in the way that race and gender are being handled.
What I think is happening is multi-leveled. On the one hand, you have an invocation of the First Amendment in a way that blinds one to the moral censure involved, so that you really have what I think is a discussion that's almost beside the point. I am a staunch defender of the First Amendment, but almost any time I raise issues of how race and gender are discussed, people say I am interfering with somebody's First Amendment rights, so that the issue of legal censoring replaces the discussion of moral censure. And we desperately need a discussion of moral censure. And and the First Amendment is never absolute in that sense anyway. I mean, people cannot call their bosses racial epithets, and yet certainly you have a First Amendment right to do so, but the issue in the workplace is clearly not that. People can't... it is almost, for example, as though somebody who started yelling and screaming drunkenly all over the place would clearly be able to be dismissed from an academic environment as being sort of crazy. But if while they were yelling drunkenly and falling over all over the place, as in the Brown incident, the Brown student who was dismissed, if they also yell racial epithets or gender slurs, then somehow they become a hero. And I find that very troubling, and we need to discuss the power implications of that. It is almost as though people are saying, I have my First Amendment right to call you nigger, so you shut up about it. That seems to me the tenor of these discussions.
Patricia Williams is the author of The Alchemy of Race and Rights. This is Fresh Air.